Support for KQED comes from European Sleepworks, the store that bases its design and materials on research factors affecting sleep, including comfort and support, humidity levels, and ease of breathing. Details online about their mattresses and bedding at sleepworks.com. KQED Live and Lit Quake present A Night with Songwriter, a podcast that turns stories into songs, featuring author Susan Orlean and songwriter Diana Gameros. June 13th, tickets at kqed.org/live, supported by Berkeley Rep. It's starting to warm up around the Bay Area today. Current temperatures around the Bay, it's 66 in San Francisco, 79 in Concord, 81 in Tracy, and also 81 up in Sacramento. We're expecting a bit of a cool down, and then on Tuesday, the temperatures really spike with highs forecast in the lower 100s. There's a heat advisory in effect from 8 a.m. Tuesday to midnight Thursday. This is KQED San Francisco and KQEI North Highlands, Sacramento.
Welcome to City Arts and Lectures, a season of talks and onstage conversations with some of the most celebrated writers, artists, and thinkers of our day, recorded before an audience at the Sydney Goldstein Theater in San Francisco. Our guest today is Justice Stephen G. Breyer. During his 28-year tenure on the United States Supreme Court, Justice Breyer authored 551 opinions. Among the most notable, his dissent in Dobbs v. Jackson. Breyer has been a liberal voice on other issues too, including criminal sentencing and environmental protections. In 2022, he was succeeded by Justice Ketanji Brown Jackson. Jackson was Breyer's former law clerk. On May 22, 2024, on the occasion of his new book, Reading the Constitution, Why I Chose Pragmatism, Not Textualism, Justice Breyer came to the Sydney Goldstein Theater in San Francisco, where he spoke with Sarah Isker, host of the podcast Advisory Opinions, and a writer and host for The Dispatch, a conservative media outlet. Previously, Isker was the spokesperson for the Department of Justice under former President Donald Trump. Join us now for a conversation with Justice Stephen G. Breyer.
When I was thinking about the Supreme Court, and I feel like a lot of people see the Supreme Court through an ideological, through a partisan lens, and I feel like there's a lot of media attention that's paid to that partisan lens, and not a lot paid to, you know, the justices most likely to be in dissent right now are Alito and Thomas from last term. That the only five cases last term were decided 6-3 along ideological lines, that 9 out of 10 cases decided last term had at least one of the liberal justices in the majority. And so something that I've talked some about is this idea that thinking of the Supreme Court only along that x-axis, that ideological axis, can't be the full story, that there has to be this second dimension, a y-axis, whatever you want to call it, that must have something else going on, institutionalism, consequentialism, something beyond that sort of ideological axis. I'm curious if you felt like it was a 6-3 court or a 3-3-3 court, and how you would define that other axis beyond the ideological side.
That's not quite the job. I mean, the job is, we have about, 70, 80 cases in a year. What are those cases? You want to know the example that I use? I put in the book about explaining to the college students, law school students, what do? Can I give that example? Take a second.
This is the snail.
Yeah, the snail.
I love snails.
All right.
I had pet snails growing up.
This is absolutely true. I read in a newspaper, a French newspaper somewhere, that there was a biology teacher, and he goes from Nantes to Paris, and he has 20 live snails in a basket. Okay, remember, I'm talking, let's say, to the seventh grade, and they're looking out the window. So snails, I got a little interested. So the conductor comes up, and he says, what's in that basket? He looks. Snails. He says, you have a ticket for the snails? The teacher says, what are you talking about? Ticket for the snails. He says, read the fare book. It says no animals on the train unless they're in a basket, in which case you have to buy a half fare ticket. So the president said, what are you talking about? That's about dogs or cats or maybe rabbits. It's not about snails. You think it's about mosquitoes and fleas? I mean, it's ridiculous. He says, is a snail an animal? Okay. So I say, now you got it. Got it? Is a snail an animal? Mm-hmm. So I'd say that's what we do on the Supreme Court. Maybe it's not snails. Maybe it's the freedom of speech. Maybe it's the right to bear arms. But there's some words somewhere. Now, what do you think about that? Do you think he has to pay the fare or not? Fabulous question, because I don't have to say another word for the whole rest of the period. And they break down into, they're arguing, yes, but a snail's an animal, isn't it? And then, no.
That's the textualist.
It's not that guy. Yeah, right. Correct. And I say, that's what we do. Except that the cases that we have are pretty difficult. Of course, the snail case is difficult. But who knows, maybe we'll have it. We had a case about the meaning of a comma in the Internal Revenue Code. It was the next word, which was a for, a which, or a that. I don't know. But I thought that was an interesting case. No one else did. But regardless, the cases we have, lower court judges have come to different conclusions on the same question of federal law. So maybe 5 of those cases, or 10 max, will attract the press attention that a few get. But those are ones that are connected with people's politics or social questions or something like that. But the most of them are not. And so when people ask me, what's my favorite case that I wrote? That's a little self-centered. But nonetheless, what one? Google versus Oracle. Why? Because I think it will affect a lot of people, and it took me 2 years to figure out what was the Java language? I thought Java was a place in the Indian Ocean somewhere. But nonetheless, we had to learn it. And we had to get that right enough. So there were two opposite positions there that were not both of them, usually, fairly intelligible, intelligent, good arguments. We have to decide it. And after 2 years or so, we did. And I had to learn what Java was. And that's...
Can you code now?
Hmm?
Can you code?
Are you kidding? I have to learn it well enough to understand the briefs. And what would please me about that, I don't usually do this. I don't usually do it. I don't usually go look at what the lawyers are saying afterwards. I don't. Why should I? The winning lawyers will think it's great, and the losing lawyers will think you're an idiot, but they won't say it. All right. But nonetheless, I did there, only to see, did they think we got it right, not the result, but the way we understood the case. And they did. It's worth the 2 years. Okay? Do you understand what we do? So then you come along, and the press or somebody comes along and says, is he a conservative, a liberal, a what? Please. I mean, I learned from a president who told me this. The applause dies away. Very quickly. Very quickly. And you're left with the job, so you better like it. And after 2 or 3 years, I go to a reception in the Supreme Court. A young lawyer comes up and says, Justice Breyer, we think your opinions are so wonderful. Will you ever sign my program? So I say, sure, I sign his program. As he walks away, he turns to his friend, and he says, that makes 4. Okay, got it? We understand that. And that's right. You better like the job. And the job is deciding these snail cases, but the same kind of thing. And they're difficult cases, or they wouldn't be in our court. And 28 years of doing that, I'm glad I did, of course. But it's not something that's easily broken down into whether on certain cases that have a lot of social or political content, you are labeled this or that.
By the way, one of my favorite cases of the last several terms is the angry cheerleader case, where a cheerleader uses Snapchat off school property, off school time, to say something negative about her cheerleading situation, not making the varsity team. And I'm very curious whether for that case, did you and the clerks, did they teach you how to use Snapchat? Did they get that on your phone?
We didn't need that, but that case is a good example of something else that's hard. Is what are the words you put on that paper? What the cheerleader did, she wanted to be on the first rank of the cheerleaders, and she was put on the second rank, and she was really annoyed about it. And what she said, I guess I can say that, she said, cheerleaders, okay? That's what she said. All right, it wasn't very polite. And the school tried to discipline her for that, which she did at her local shop, local whatever it was, coffee place,
yeah,
where she drinks coffee with pumpkin seed in it or something. But in any case, she sent that out, and they disciplined her. And could they, or was she protected by the First Amendment? Now, here's the problem in writing it. Yes, we said she is protected by the First Amendment, actually. This has too little to do with school. It didn't affect discipline or anything else. But I don't want to say that the First Amendment for schools, high schools, grammar schools, is exactly the same application as anywhere else. Yeah, in a sense it is, but in a sense it isn't. The schools have power to discipline, and I want to say that. But I don't want them to forget the importance of allowing people to say what they think. Okay? Now, how do I do that? And I thought one of my clerks really came up with this, if I'm honest about it. She found, or I knew it was there, in the D.C. wedding service, some words that I could stick in the opinion, which I did. I don't know if they do any good at all. But these were the words, and I, probably because I grew up in San Francisco and knew about the public schools, and I said, America's public schools are the nurseries of democracy. Okay? Now, why did I say that? Because I don't want them to forget that in this democracy, our problem in the First Amendment is part, not of the problem, but of the solution the founders came up with. That it's going to be a public opinion created through the clash of ideas, as Holmes said, the marketplace, which when formulated in different parts will be transmitted. And that's the last line. Petition the government for redress of grievances. It starts with freedom of thought. That's religion. And it goes through speech. Speech. You don't say everything you think. If I said everything I think, when I say everything I think, I get into a lot of trouble. But the point is, yes, think what you want. And of that, say what you want. And when you say what you want, then the press will transmit some of it, sometimes, to others. And then opinion will form. And then it's assembly. Assembly to discuss it. And create public opinions of different kinds, which then go to Congress, which is the public forum for people to debate what others in their constituency think. This is Bert Newborn's idea. It's not original. Nothing I do is original. But the point is, yes. That's there. That's important. Keep that in mind, public schools, when some student gets carried away.
Let's move to the court in the news a little bit. You testified in Congress in 2015 that there should not be a more formal code of ethics for Supreme Court justices because it could require more recusals. You said, I have a duty to sit as well as a duty not to sit. I can hear your voice saying that.
No, that's true. That's true more in the Supreme Court than other courts, because if you disqualify yourself in the Supreme Court, there are going to be 8 people left. If I'm in the First Circuit, which I was, and I disqualify myself, they can put somebody else in my place. There are plenty of judges around or up there. But you can't do that in the Supreme Court. So I said, be careful. You have a duty to sit and a duty not to sit. So suppose somebody comes in, as they have from time to time, and says, I should recuse myself. What I do, I'm only talking about myself, but there are 7 volumes of ethical rules that apply to federal judges. So I look at those 7 volumes and I look it up. And I say, what does it say? And how does that apply to me? And if it's tough, and sometimes it is tough, I call an ethics expert. The law schools are filled with them. And I find them quite useful. So of course, every judge understands that ethics is important. Every judge understands that.
Do you worry about the drop in approval of the Supreme Court? It dropped about 20 points from 2020 to 2021, which I find interesting because that's before Dobbs was decided. That's before a lot of the ethics stuff was in the news. But a 20-point drop in a trust in any institution is not good.
No, it isn't good.
Inside the institution, did you worry?
The reason that it's tough is because, I put to you, you have a friend. That friend is the most unpopular person in the United States. Really unpopular. I'm sure you have no friends like that, but you might.
Some of them are here tonight.
Yeah, I don't know. You might. And if that friend was on trial for his life or for his prison or for a fine or for anything else, do you want the judge to be moved by public opinion? Of course not. On the other hand, if in the Supreme Court, you see, the public doesn't, the rule of law itself depends upon the public and not just lawyers and judges. And I tried to explain this to a woman who was the Chief Justice of Ghana. And she said, why? She's trying to make it a little bit more human rights in there. And she says, why do people do what you say? That's a good question. We're just nine human beings, after all. And I have to go through examples. I have to begin with Andrew Jackson and the Cherokee Indians, where John Marshall and Joseph Story said, that northern Georgia, where they found gold, that belongs to the Indians. It does not belong to the Georgians. Very clear, very definite. And Andrew Jackson supposedly said, John Marshall made his decision, now let him enforce it. And he sent troops to northern Georgia, but not to enforce the Supreme Court decision, but to throw the Indians out on the Trail of Tears, where they marched to Oklahoma and their descendants live to this day. Joseph Story wrote to Marshall, this is the end, he said. But it wasn't. And America's gone through all kinds of things. I mean, we had a civil war, we had slavery, we had Jim Crow, I mean, my goodness. And I was a law clerk 10 years after Brown was decided. And I come away from working for Arthur Goldberg at the Supreme Court with an impression that they were still very worried about would it be enforced. Would it be enforced? Who helped them? Congress, I don't think, helped them very much. Eisenhower did in sending the 101st Airborne into Little Rock. But would they do it? Would they? Holmes wrote an opinion years before Brown where he said, of course they don't let black people vote in the South and that's illegal. But if I say that, nobody will do it. You see, he wrote that in his opinion. Very interesting. So they found some excuse not to decide that case or something. But by Brown, by the time it came along, the country, it was a good chance. And look at sometimes, look at Thurgood Marshall's arguments in the Supreme Court. Fabulous. He doesn't say how illegal segregation is because he knows that every one of those judges agree with him about that. What he spends most of his time doing, or much of it, in the oral argument, is he's saying to the court, if you decide what you know is right, people will follow it. And what I say to the classes when I'm teaching them, 10 years later, well, maybe, Cooper versus Aaron. I told an Air Force judge from Russia, an Air Force general, State Department called up. This was after the Iron Curtain fell. Said, be nice to this man because he's the one in charge of missiles and they used to be pointed at the U.S. and he changed the direction. So he says, what's your favorite case? I said, not Brown, but Cooper versus Aaron. Because nine judges signed that opinion saying, integrate Central High School in Little Rock. Yeah. But the day after they wrote that, Governor Faubus, I can remember, closed the school. Closed Central High School. Nobody got educated. Just what Herbert Brownell and Eisenhower and the others who sent the troops was afraid of. You see, and so I say, you thought this was a happy ending, but it wasn't. Ah, well, I'm not sure. Why not? Because it was too late for Faubus. It was too late. That was the era of Martin Luther King, of the bus boycotts, of the Freedom Riders, and the North had awakened to the problem. Throughout the country, public opinion, you say? Public opinion had shifted. And it was too late for the South to say, we're not going to follow Brown. And they didn't. And so why do I tell those stories? Because I say the story is that you, sometimes they're the South, but sometimes say Bush v. Gore. You know, I dissented in Bush v. Gore. I thought it was wrong. But I told the class at Stanford, I said, the amazing thing is what Senator Reed, who was a Democrat, said in the Supreme Court, he said, the amazing thing about that is rarely remarked. People didn't like it. They thought it was wrong. At least half the country, maybe a little more than half, thought it was terrible. But regardless, they did follow it without throwing stones, without rioting. And I said to the class at Stanford, I know that at least a third of you think, too bad there weren't a few riots. Too bad there weren't some stones thrown. Is that? But I say, before you conclude that that's what we should do, go look at the television set and go see what happens in countries that make their decisions that way. You see, I'm telling her, the woman from Ghana, the people you have to convince to follow decisions sometimes they think are really wrong are not the judges. They get paid for that. Not the lawyers. But contrary to popular belief, 329 million of our 330 million people are not lawyers. Hardly anyone believes that. But they're the ones you have to convince. So go to the villages. Send the lawyers out to the villages. Go to the towns. Go and explain why a rule of law makes sense. Now that's a little long, but you see why I worry about the drop? You see why? And but where do you find the right balance there? Because you don't want your friend, who was very unpopular, to be in a court where the judge is paying attention to what the newspapers say about him. All right? So like most of the questions that you actually have to face in your life or mine, they're tough. They're difficult. Find a middle point. Find some point. Try to answer them.
Can you tell us about a case or topic of law that you've changed your mind about over the course of your career?
Oh, there, I'm sure there. You don't look back. Sandra O'Connor told me that. She said the two rules that unwritten rules that people adjust to, and they'll do it. Nobody speaks twice in conference till everybody's spoken once. That's a very good rule. And I was a junior member of the court for 11 years. I almost held the world record. Joseph Story beat me by 11 days. And I was thinking to my predecessor, you know, I would say, wait for 11 days to get sworn in, then I'll go down in history as the answer to a trivia question. Fabulous. But nonetheless, what was your question?
Something you've changed your mind about.
Yes. Okay, I do. But the second rule, she said, is tomorrow is another day. You and I on the court were the greatest of allies in case one. Case two, we're totally opposite. You see? And so you decide the case, and now it's on to the next case. And I learned something from Arthur Goldberg about that. We'd get defeated on something or other, and I'd say to the justice, I'd say, gee, we were so right. That's terrible. And I'd bang on about it. And he would say, so what do you want me to do about that? What we do, I'll tell you what we do, he'd say. We go on to the next case. And we'll win that one. And then we go on to the next one. And that's what we do. All right? So what do I, the one that comes to my mind, there was something, this shows you something else about the court, too. It's rather interesting to me. It was something about committing people to a mental asylum after they'd served their criminal sentence. And there was some question in there. And I was supposed to write an opinion for the court. And I started doing it, and I couldn't get it to write properly. And I thought about it, I changed my mind. Now the person who then was going to write the opinion for the court, because I was then going to dissent, was Clarence Thomas. And I said to Clarence, shall I circulate my draft? Because then you see what you're up against, my dissent. And then you can write the, he said, I don't know. I said, well, maybe we should ask the Chief Justice, Rehnquist, in the conference. So, So in conference I said to, the chief, I said, well, you know, I've changed my mind on this. You've seen the memos. And is it all right if I circulate my draft dissent before the majority circulates? And Rehnquist says, well, he says, does Clarence mind? And Clarence says, no, I don't mind. It's fine. And so the chief says, well, circulate it if you want. It's no big deal. So I said, Clarence, we found the first goddamn thing around here that's no big deal.
Can you give us an example? Well, in your book, for instance, you talk many times about one of the problems is that originalism says one of its virtues is that judges can't come out simply in their policy preference.
Yeah.
When in fact, you point out many times that that's not the case, that it's not as constraining as originalists and textualists may think. And I think that's a problem with any jurisprudential philosophy, is how do you keep judges from just saying, well, if I were in Congress, this is how I would have voted, so that's what I'm going to do. I'm curious if you can give an example of a case that came out differently than what your policy preference would have been, that the legal outcome was different than your policy outcome.
Look at about 200 death penalty cases. Is that good enough? I wrote an opinion, so I can discuss that. In the opinion, I said the court should reconsider its decision that the death penalty is constitutional. I didn't say what I thought exactly. I'm not saying what I think exactly now. But nonetheless, it had a sort of anti-death penalty approach. And I did write 42 pages, I think, about it, which even for me is pretty long, and has a lot of facts and figures and so forth. Okay, you're reading that and then read the cases that I decided upholding the application of death penalty, because I said I'm not going to dissent in every death penalty case if I don't have a majority. And I did not have a majority. All right? So there are quite a few.
A topic that has obviously been a big one of late is the overturning of Roe versus Wade in the Dobbs decision. And you write about that in your book. You also write about a case called Heller. So in 2008, y'all held, it's like a weird thing to say, oh, the Supreme Court, you. you were in dissent, but the Supreme Court held that the Second Amendment protects an individual right to keep arms in the home for self-defense. And something that you say in the book is that at least a very plausible way of looking at the Second Amendment is that no, it protected an individual right to train for a militia, but that self-defense is nowhere in there. And so self-defense would be an unenumerated right in the Constitution, the right to keep arms for self-defense. And so in that sense, the Second Amendment right, sorry, the right to self-defense being an unenumerated right, and the right to abortion being an unenumerated right, actually, jurisprudentially, are kind of similar. And so you talk about how Roe v. Wade shouldn't have been overturned. I'm curious if you think Heller should be overturned and why you would treat the two cases differently if we're talking about that same unenumerated right, that states should have some ability to regulate unenumerated rights, why one and not the other?
Well, you could think of lots of things, the right to eat a lollipop or something, I mean, that aren't in the Constitution. And that doesn't mean they exist or don't exist. But you have at the base of your question something that is a very serious and very difficult problem. And the way the court has traditionally referred to this problem is with two words, ordered liberty. And the virtue of those two words is that nobody really knows what they mean. And if you, in fact, are interested, my own view of who's written the best on that subject is Justice Harlan in Poe v. Ullman.
One or two Harlan?
Two.
Harlan two, okay.
Yeah. It used to be considered a more conservative justice. Well, he wrote an opinion, he went along with their finding a right to use contraceptives or whatever the thing was in that case. It was one of the marital, you know, rights. But he said, how do we decide this? And ordered liberty. Well, we look back into history, because the words won't be there. Go read McCulloch versus Maryland, John Marshall. Great opinion, one of the first. And he says, this is a constitution we are expounding. And what he means by that, it's at a certain level of abstraction. So don't look for detailed words in there. He's saying, he's had to decide in that case whether the Congress had the power to pass a law creating a bank of the United States. And you know how many times the word bank appears in the Constitution? She does know. Zero. Okay? But he held they did have that right because of the abstract, certain abstract words that are there in the Constitution. So read what Harlan writes there and how you go back into history and look, but more than that, he says you also look to the application today, and he talks about channeling that application into the future. Does that mean the judge can just do anything he wants? No. I kept saying when I get that question, which I have many times, I say, I never do what I want. Well, that's not quite true. But nonetheless, you're there as a judge. If you want to just do what you want, what you think is good, then run for office. Or if you don't want to run for office, work on the staff, as I did for Senator Kennedy. Work on the staff of someone who did obtain public office, and you'll have more leeway, but not as a judge.
You're listening to Justice Stephen G. Breyer in conversation with Sarah Isker. This is City Arts and Lectures.
You don't have to have definite rules. You don't usually have definite, absolute rules that determine an outcome. Law is not computer science, and it isn't any kind of science. But there are limits, channels, approaches, norms. Go back to 1584 and read what Montesquieu writes. He writes the same thing people write today. He writes that there are approaches that you use. There are general standards. There are ways of behaving. And you learn that. Maybe I've learned a little bit after 40 years. You realize that? 40 years. That's terrible. That couldn't be true. But 40 years as a judge, Court of Appeals, the Supreme Court. And that's why I really wrote this book. I wrote it because maybe I've learned something. I don't know if other people will benefit or not. I hope they will. But I write why and how. With a lot of examples. I use a lot of examples because I know there are probably 200 law teachers who know more about the theory of it than I do, but I've had some experience they haven't had. And I want to write about that experience and tell them in this book, when and how have I sometimes looked back to what? Somebody had some purpose in writing that statutory language. Somebody in Congress had an idea. What were they trying to do? What was their purpose? Consequences. If we decide this way, what's going to happen in terms of our beliefs and in terms of those purposes? Values. What are those values? This is the document. I have it still in my pocket. This is the document that helps hold us together. And you go look at that and you see democracy. It's there. Basic human rights. A degree, we hope, of equality. The rule of law. Separation of powers, those basic values, you read it. You can't help but they come through. And John Marshall saw that. And how does this statute and this interpretation stack up? Sometimes that's relevant, sometimes it isn't. And so, but you're ready to use those things if they're relevant and if they help. And that's what I'm trying to explain. And now I forget the question again. Oh, you see, she's
just
forgotten
abortion and no, guns. If abortion and guns are both unenumerated rights, one and not the other?
Because abortion is part. There are a lot of different theories on that. And the strongest argument, in my opinion, for just letting Roe v. Wade alone, it had been the law 50 years. For 50 years, that had been the law. And 30 years, I think, on Casey. And so I have my imaginary textualist. What's a textualist? A textualist is someone who thinks, or an originalist.
That a snail is an animal.
Yeah, that's right. That a snail is an animal. That's exactly right. That's exactly right. You go, what did it mean, though? What did it mean to the persons who were alive and reasonable at the time the language went into the Constitution? Hey, I can't resist making this. It's a sort of obvious point. But when that language about equal protection of the laws, when the language about not taking away people's life, liberty, or property without due process of law, when that language went into the Constitution, which is just after the Civil War, it seems to me there was about half the country that was not represented in the political process. Perhaps. Ah, yes, exactly, exactly. And so we're going to go back and figure out what all those people thought when half, more than half the country, really. Because they were the people just liberated from slavery. And they weren't part of it, okay? So be careful about looking at what people thought at that time and the fact that they didn't. That they didn't mention something. I mean, that they didn't mention something shows something, but not everything. And there were a lot of things to look at. And if Roe, you don't agree with Roe, you can say, well, Casey repaired some of the intellectual part that people were arguing with, like Ruth Ginsburg. I mean, she argued with some of Roe. She thought it wasn't as reasoned as much as she'd like. And so they cured that, I think. But anyway, they've been the law for 30. So my imaginary textualist, right, imaginary, I say to that textualist, why? It's been the law for 50 years. Is it that you overruled this because you thought they didn't use originalism or textualism? I know what the answer to that is. No, that isn't the reason. That isn't the reason. Okay, because if it is the reason, about almost all the cases that the Supreme Court ever decided would be up for grabs. And nobody's going to think that, in my opinion. All right. Then why did you overrule it? Well, I think the person will answer, possibly, because it says it in the opinion. Because it was terribly wrong. Didn't use the word terribly when I did it. But nonetheless, very, very wrong. I say, oh, I see. You're ready to overrule those cases that you think are terribly wrong, but not those that you think are right. Yeah, I get it. But you think that the problem of judges substituting what they think is right or wrong for the law is something that exists only with judges who are not textualists, but it doesn't exist with you? Maybe I should repeat that. What you're doing is deciding whether these old cases were right or wrong. Mm-hmm. But you're not going to just substitute what you want for what's the law. But a judge who doesn't follow your approach of textualism might. Is that what you're saying?
So if Heller makes it to 30 years, you don't overturn it?
I'm not on the court then, so I can't say. I can't really say what people will do in the future. But I think the main problem with Heller and Bruin and so forth was what you say. They got their history wrong, the majority. And in Heller, John Stevens wrote a pretty good opinion, I thought, in showing that this history really shows that they're interested in the militia. It's not about people having guns under their pillow to scare away burglars or whatever. It's not about that. It was because...
Sounds like it was terribly wrong, though.
Well, which was terribly wrong?
Heller. Heller was terribly wrong?
Look, I didn't write the words terribly wrong. That was the opinion I dissented from. And by the way, the dissent will show, if you read that dissent, you will see that the argument about when you overrule a case is one argument about after about 50 reasons why this decision is wrong, okay? That's what we were writing. But I picked that up because it seems to me somewhat contradictory for the textualist or the originalist to say, oh, it's only the people who follow traditional methods of interpretation where there's a risk that they'll substitute their own beliefs for the law. There's that risk just as much with the other, just as much, and particularly when you start overruling cases. All right, I'll stay away from this because I express my... When I get really sort of upset about a case, my approach to doing it, and I don't recommend it, but I try to write a dissent or join a dissent that even a child of two would have to say the dissent was right. Now, I can't guarantee I'm always successful at that objective, but I haven't asked many children of two lately as to whether they have read my dissents. But there are many reasons in that dissent why we thought, and they're all public, why we thought the majority was wrong to overrule those cases. And just one of them is related to the textualism point.
You mentioned the Equal Protection Clause and women not having the right to vote at that time of the Equal Protection Clause. And I find that so interesting because under your reading of the Equal Protection Clause, as I understand it, the 19th Amendment wouldn't have been necessary. And I think that highlights a problem with the purpose-based approach, because if you too broadly expound a constitution and expand it, it undercuts that political process, because it's so much easier to fight over a confirmation hearing for a justice than it is to ratify an amendment, to compromise, to do the hard part about convincing your fellow citizens. And so how am I supposed to think about the Equal Protection Clause, which we want to be broad, but then the 19th Amendment, which means that those who ratified the Equal Protection Clause did not think that it, for instance, included women's right to vote. And that the 19th Amendment is a good thing because it meant that everyone had to kind of get on board with that. It wasn't judges making that decision.
No, I accept that, of course. And to go back to an earlier question that you asked, what's the role of this public opinion? What's the role of people who think of politics, if you like, on the court? And I think the best explanation was given by Paul Freund, who was a very good scholar, great scholar of constitutional law. And he said this: no judge is moved, or should be moved, or is moved by the temperature of the day. But all judges are aware of the climate of the era. Now, you have to think about that, because no one really knows what it means. But the way that the Equal Protection Clause applies to women is something that developed, discrimination against women, is something that developed over time. And that's true of many of the rules of constitutional law, or the approaches, or the theories, etc.
But it takes the pressure off the political branches, what? And it puts the pressure on the Supreme Court.
That's a problem. If you go too much too fast, and what's too much? And how do you what goes beyond the limits that are there now in the words and the principles and so forth of this part of the Constitution or that. And you think I have a clear, rule-based answer to that? No, of course not. And if I did, then law would be something of a science. But it's not. And you go back to 1584, and what he says in that essay, it's a great essay on experience, and what he says, I think, is that life exceeds the bounds of any law, or any group of laws, or any idea that people have now of what the law should be forever. Be careful. Human life has no limit to the experience that people will have, do have, are going to have. We don't know. We don't know. And so you have to have an approach that limits you, of course. And that's true under any theory of interpreting the Constitution. And you expect someone to say what it is they can say, but they're not. I don't believe them. I don't believe them. And so the 19th Amendment question is a good question, because actually, by the time the 19th Amendment comes along, we're living in a different world. Or as Ruth Bader Ginsburg liked to put it, it isn't true anymore that the woman's place is in the home. No longer true, and that's true by the time they pass this. And so that's obvious. But that's the problem of interpreting constitutional law. And what do you want to do? Change human life? Maybe we should.
You give this great example in your book. And overall, your point is, everyone's using standards, not rules. Mm-hmm. Law is about standards, not rules. And so you give an example of the speed limit, right? We have a speed limit, that's a rule, 55 miles an hour. But we could have a standard of driving dangerously.
Yes, we in California, when I grew up at Lowell High School, we did have to take a course in driver ed, and the law at that time was just what you said.
Really?
Yeah.
That's terrifying. Because having...
Oh, it's worse than you think. My first summer, I worked for my uncle, and he gave me an old used car as a pay. It was a Chevy, and I don't think you wanted to see me drive. And Joanna says that my driving has not improved.
It's a good thing we have the marshals here.
Right.
Having a 55-mile-an-hour speed limit as a rule is both over- and under-inclusive. Right? Can there be people driving very safely at 65 miles an hour, and there's people who drive very dangerously like you at 45 miles an hour, 20 miles an hour, et cetera. And so that's your point. Standards are better than rules because they
sometimes,
can take
not
that
always,
into effect.
Not always. You better have a rule as to how many days you can wait before filing that appeal.
True.
You better have a rule when it tells you how many words you can put in that brief that you just filed in my brother's court.
I was going to say, now you're just saying rules that are helpful to you as a justice. Wait a second.
Are there others? That's a good point.
But it occurred to me in reading that in the book, because I thought it was such a good example and an easy one of the difference between standards and rules, that part of the reason that over time, I think societies tend to move from a standards-based society to a rules-based society, is that standards can be applied very unfairly. That it would turn out in a don't drive dangerously speed limit, that we might find that it was more common that men were found to drive safely at 65 miles an hour, and more common to find that women were found to drive not safely at 45 miles an hour. And then we'd have an argument over whether that was because men and women drive differently, or because the people applying the standards were doing so unfairly or in a biased way. And so at the end of the day, we just moved to a rule, it's 55 miles an hour, and we can apply that to everyone equally. And isn't that a problem with standards? And that's why we move to rules, and that's why something like textualism, for instance, which is more of a rule-based legal philosophy, I think, is attractive to some people, because it's like, look, if you didn't write the words, if you didn't get that law passed the way you wanted to, then go do it again, but it's not my job to read into a standard, because that can be applied unfairly.
Why do I do that? Because it depends on the case. It depends on what you're talking about. Procedural rules in courts are probably better in the form of rules. I'm sure they are. And other things like the First Amendment, standards will help. Be careful of becoming too rule-based. Be careful. You might say something like, which I've written against a lot, content-based regulations. You see, content-based regulations violate the First Amendment. They do? I mean, the court's written that as a kind of rule. Yeah, I see. But on the wall of my office there's the U.S. Code, and the U.S. Code is filled with content-based regulations. Try the SEC. Are you really going to apply that to every government agency? No. Can't be done. Or if we're done, okay. So sometimes it's rules, and sometimes you want standards. You want me to tell you when? I don't have an absolute rule for that.
It's a standard.
And I don't have a standard either. You have to. That's what judges do. Judges in appeals courts decide whether a snail is an animal. Okay? If you wanted me to really go into the answer to that question, I don't know. And we'll never find out, because the railroad company reimbursed the poor teacher for his expenses.
Wait, that was a real story?
Yes. You think I make these things up?
Yes. Definitely thought that was made up.
No.
So wait, what's the ending to it? He pays the ticket
yes.
for each snail, and then
no, not for each snail. The conductor was not totally
one basket.
Yeah, one basket full of snails, right?
See, that doesn't seem like that was textualist. You had to pay per snail.
Doesn't say anything about that in the snail. But maybe. Regardless, it was written in the newspaper what I told you, and I read. I believed. Don't take my stories about what goes on when I read in the newspaper as accurate. But nonetheless, I believe that the company reimbursed the professor.
Well, perhaps we could just work it out in civil society, and that's really the answer, is to keep it out of the courts.
Well, there. I can't remember who wrote this. He said, if you had a society, and that's the first thing I asked the students, the seventh graders, ever been any arguments? Ever get into arguments with your brother, your sister, your parents? Yeah. And what happened after that? Well, they got over it somehow. They got over it. So I say there are probably 4 billion arguments in the United States every year. And almost all of them you get over it. But some you can't. Crimes or big money or torts or all kinds of things. Some you can't get over. So who do you go to, I ask them. And they say, that's too fast. No, no, you don't. You go to a lawyer. And the lawyer is supposed to help you get over this argument. And he's supposed to talk maybe to the other lawyers. And most settle. Not many cases get into court. But if you can't settle it, well, even on the steps of the courtroom, they'll settle it. Chuck will tell us. But a few get through. And I once asked Justice Liakis, chairman of the SJC in Massachusetts, how many cases do you think really get into court? He said, 16 million. I said, really? He said, but most are traffic tickets. So I said, really? And he said, but only 2 or 3 million are real cases. Ah. I said, how do you know? He said, I don't know. I just made it up, actually. But there are a lot.
And of those, 58 get to the Supreme Court.
Well, how does it work? One side wins, the other side loses, if they go to trial and they don't settle during the proceeding. Remember, the judge doesn't decide the facts, usually. It's the jury that decides the facts. The judge says the law and tells the jury if there's a jury in the case. Fine. One side wins, the other side loses. The lawyer who loses thinks the judge is an idiot. I already told you that. So he made mistakes of law, thinks that losing lawyer. Now, what does the winning lawyer think of the judge? What do you think he thinks? What do you think?
Solomonic wisdom, right?
No. He doesn't think anything of the judge. He thinks he's a good lawyer. The losing lawyer appeals. We go to the Court of Appeals, or maybe we go to the California Supreme Court eventually. And eventually, if you look at all of these cases in a year, and how many involve issues of federal law, that's Congress or the administrative agencies or the Constitution, how many? Maybe 100,000. And of those, maybe 80,000, let's say 80,000 just to round it off, because about 8,000 ask the court to take their case. That's the only place left for them to go. And we take about 80, okay? And so it isn't the Supreme Court that's deciding these seven, it's maybe eight. Well, why? Every week I get on my desk, I got, big stack of memos written by the law clerks, all the people who ask, 150 a week, that we have a pool, and I look through the, well, how can I look through those and narrow it down to maybe that out of that? And I say, because I'm looking for something. We take a case almost always because the lower courts have come to different conclusions on the same question of federal law. If they've come to the same conclusion, why us? They're perfectly good judges. But if they've come to different conclusions, well, there's a need for some uniformity across the country, so we'll probably take it. So that's what I'm looking for. Not 100%. If a lower court judge says that a law of Congress is unconstitutional, we'll probably take that case.
Do you think y'all should be taking more cases?
It's not
the
a
number
should.
Keeps
Sandra
going
O'Connor
down.
Used to sit there in the conference, and she would always say, we've got to take more cases. I found some over here. We found some over there. You know, I'd say, that's why I started with this. If you have a country where people don't have big arguments and they decide all different, good. Good. Excellent. I think there was a Chinese philosopher who said that. There was, I promise. And so we're trying to help people resolve their problems under law. And we're taking cases where there's differences of points of view. That's almost all of them. Sometimes, say Guantanamo, we'll take a case because we think the country needs a Supreme Court decision. And in Guantanamo, we had four cases. Each of those was brought by a person who was not popular. Do you think Bin Laden's driver was popular? In each of those, that plaintiff is suing a Secretary of Defense or the President of the United States, and in each of those cases, the plaintiff won. And we said Congress cannot take away that Guantanamo prisoner's right to come into a court, for example. Okay? And we took that because we thought the country needed that. I think we're right in that. The court isn't always right about that. It isn't always right. But the primary thing is there a split? And then we'll try to work it out. And Brandeis said, often with many of these cases, it's better to have an answer, even if the answer is the wrong answer, because people can adjust to it or Congress can do something.
You mentioned being the junior justice for 11 years, and the junior justice comes with certain responsibilities. You have to open the door at conference when there's a knock, but one of the most important responsibilities of the junior justice is to sit on the cafeteria committee. And I am curious what the most contentious fight was over the course of your 11 years on the monthly cafeteria committee meeting.
You think that was easy? There are some people who would like to have meat sandwiches for lunch, and there are others who prefer salads. How do you work that out? And why is it when I could never work that out? That I'm entrusted with deciding these constitutional decisions. That's a little tough to understand. But I said, go up to the Boston courthouse because they have a very good cafeteria. I was there for 11 years. And we got on well. I mean, we get on in the conference, I always say, which is true. I've never heard a voice raised in anger at that conference, 28 years. And really big disagreements on some cases. And I've never heard a judge on that in that conference. We're there alone.
Not Who's the funniest justice in conference?
No one is funny. Believe me, you don't. Even I try. I mean, Rehnquist would never let a joke slip in. So I was very proud of myself when I had been assigned an opinion to write, which was supposed to be unanimous, and it ended up 5-4. So I said in conference, Chief, I've discovered the way to get five people on an opinion. And he said, oh, really? What's that? I said, you start with 9. Even he thought that was slightly funny. But that's as far as you go. It's serious. You go around. People see what they say what they think about this case. And believe me, it is a mistake in that conference to go and say anything that suggests what I'm really saying is, ha, 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 I have a better argument than you, ha, ha, ha. If you say something along those lines, the other person will simply think, no, I have a better argument than you, ha, ha, ha. That gets you nowhere. And so you've learned, which I learned from Senator Kennedy, to consider, listen to what other people are saying and see where they're coming from. And then see if you can adjust, if you can say something helpful, and when you do, you get somewhere. And sometimes you do, and sometimes you don't. But that is what it's like. Nobody speaks twice until everybody's spoken once, and then there's some back and forth on the cases you've heard that week. And that's how conference was 30 years ago when I started off, and that's how it was when I retired 2 years ago.
You seem deeply optimistic about the future of the court, the country. Why?
Why am I optimistic? I'll tell you why. And it's what, listen to the questions that were asked, particularly from the high school. And they'll say, what should we do? And I say, well, my friend, don't ask me. It's your country. You're the ones who are going to have to bring us together. You are the ones. You've got to figure it out. And I'll tell you something about this document. I hope for you, and I say this at graduation sometimes, I say, I hope you find someone to love. I hope that you have a good job that's interesting. And I hope you participate in public life. And you can participate by voting. You can be on the library commission, the school board. Do something. But don't just withdraw. And Derek Bach was president of Harvard, and he wrote a good book about education. He put in there, I don't know if it's true or not, but he said that Pericles, in his great speech, the funeral oration in Athens, where he extols the virtue of Athens, he says, what do we say in Athens, 4th century B.C. or whatever it was? He says, what do we say about the man who does not participate in public life? We do not say he is a man who minds his own business. We say he is a man who has no business here. Good, tough. But good point. And I'm telling that to them. And I say, I'll tell you, I will pass on. I will pass on to you what the main thing that I think I learned from Senator Kennedy, or certainly one of the main things, and it was a great job. I love that job. It was a great job. But what he said was, on his staff, when you're on my staff, he says, you're trying to get on with the other people. We're trying to achieve something. We find it difficult. You go find someone who really believes the opposite of what you think. And sit him down and talk to him. No, don't talk too much. Listen. And if you talk a little and listen, you will be surprised that at some point that person will say something you really agree with. And as soon as you find that stated, you say, what a good point you have. What a good point. Let's see if we can work with that. And now you work with it, and you try to get somewhere. And if you get 30% of what you want, take it. Don't sit there and hold out for 100% so your followers, Norma, will say what a great man you are, woman. And you think we don't get together in this country? You should have been in Cambridge, Mass. During COVID, where people made committees, and they went through the streets to find out if the older people were okay. And I bet they did the same thing in San Francisco, or San Diego, or Des Moines. You go through this country? Yes, Mrs. Squataguazza, in my fifth grade at Grant School, where she gave an assignment, and four people had to work on it together. They got one grade. You learn how to cooperate. And that's right. Now, why do that make me optimistic? Because I see the look in their eyes. When I say that, maybe I'm making it up, but I don't think so. And so maybe I'm overly optimistic, but I hope I'm not overly. I hope it's true, and I believe it's true, that those kids in the high school, they'll be all right. The country will swing back, forth, that's how it goes. But they'll help, and that makes me optimistic.
Well, I want to thank Justice Breyer.
You've been listening to Justice Stephen G. Breyer in conversation with Sarah Isker. This program was recorded at the Sidney Goldstein Theater in San Francisco on May 22, 2024. City Arts and Lectures programs are recorded live in front of an audience in San Francisco, and you can be there. Come spend an evening with Cord Jefferson, director of American Fiction, talking to writer Percival Everett, artist Kara Walker, Yuval Harari, Malcolm Gladwell, and more.
Plus, free tickets are available to teachers and students, like me. For more information, visit cityarts.net.
These broadcasts are produced by City Arts and Lectures, in association with KQED Public Radio, San Francisco. Executive producers are Kate Goldstein-Breyer and Holly Mulder-Wallen. Alexandra Blackman is Director of Design and Communications. Assistance provided by Mark Spiro. Sydney Goldstein Technical Director, Stephen Eckert. Our post-production director is Nina Thorson. The recording engineer is Jane Heaven. Theme music composed and performed by Pat Gleason. City Arts and Lectures' founding producer is Sydney Goldstein. City Arts and Lectures programs are supported by grants for the arts of the San Francisco Hotel Tax Fund, additional funding provided by the Bernard Osher Foundation, Barry Traub, and the Friends of City Arts and Lectures. Support for recording and post-production of City Arts and Lectures is provided by Robert Mailer Anderson and Nicola Miner. To attend a live program or for a list of upcoming guests, visit our website at